From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Ever since the 50s, folk revivals have come and gone, but the gravelly voice of Dave Van Ronk has endured. On today's Fresh Air, Dave Van Ronk plays and sings for us and talks with us about music. Also today, we meet stand-up comic and social satirist Will Durst. He recently ran for office to get laughs, but the voters didn't think it was very funny. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from bassist Michael Bizio, and television critic David Bianculli serves up his thoughts on how TV covers tennis. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Dave Van Ronk is here to talk with us and play us some songs. In the late 50s and early 60s, Van Ronk was a central figure in the folk revival. A lot of his music was inspired by Southern black blues and small group jazz. He was about the first performer to play ragtime on guitar. Van Ronk helped a lot of newcomers to New York get established in Greenwich Village, including Bob Dylan. Now he's become a kind of father figure to a lot of younger folk musicians in New York. Dave Van Ronk, I want to thank you for coming and welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thanks, having a good time.
And before we talk, can I ask you to play a song for us?
Sure, why not? I've been singing this song since the 50s. No, early 50s. Down at Old Joe's barroom on a corner of the square, serving drinks as usual, and the usual crowd was there. On my left stood Big Joe McKennedy, his eyes bloodshot red. Turned to the crowd around him, these are the very words he said. I went down to that St. James Infirmary, saw my baby there, stretched out on a long white table, so sweet, so cold, so fair. Let her go, God bless her, wherever she may be. She may search this wide world over, never find a sweet man like me. When I die, please bury me in my high-top Stetson hat. Put a $20 gold piece on my watch chain. God'll know I died standing back. I want 6 scrap shooters for ball bearers. Corey's gonna sing me a song. Put a jazz band on my hearse while you're as hell as I stole along. Roll out your rubber tired carriage. Roll out your old time hack. 12 men go into the graveyard. 8-11 coming back. Now that I told my story, I'll take another shot of booze. And if anybody should have to ask you, I've got those gambler's blues. Let her go, God bless her, wherever she may be. She may search this wide world over, never find a sweet man. Thank you.
good. My guess is Dave Van Ronk. Singing sounds much more jazz inflected than before.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've been concentrating on.
Yeah, how come?
I don't know. You get tired of doing the song the same way all the time. And when you increase your vocabulary in terms of dynamics, phrasing, intervals, and so on and so on, it gives you more freedom. So you find things in songs that you've been doing for a long time that you hadn't known were there before, and sometimes you actually really surprise yourself.
I think vocally, what you're most famous for, in a way, besides your material, but a style that you're very famous for is a really growly kind of singing, which you did a little bit on the song, but you also spent a lot of time not singing that
way
at all.
Yeah, well, sure. The object of that is to supply some contrast. Now, you can't do that all the time. You can't do that much. Use it for contrast. I used to do that entirely too much.
When did you start thinking that it was too much and that you had a
Well, it was just a question. It didn't come about that way. I found myself doing other things instead. And then gradually I began to see that that is just one effect, one coloration among many. And learn to spot that and think in terms of, okay, now we don't do an entire chorus with that. That's too much.
How did you start singing that way?
Well, it's a standard device of jazz and blues singers, or has been since the turn of the century. It's a false bass, a bass falsetto, essentially. And I used to hear, there were a lot of horn players back in the 20s, it used to use that kind of growl effect on the horn, which essentially was what they were doing was they were imitating a vocal style that preceded that even. So I'd been listening to like Louis Armstrong sing. See, Armstrong uses that bass falsetto a lot. Blind Willie Johnson, the gospel singer, used to sing entire numbers in it, which, in my opinion, is a bit too much, especially for a man who had such a beautiful, clear treble falsetto. It's a pity he didn't play them off one against the other. It was an easily obtainable effect, and it worked very, very well on stage. And so I started to do it, and the more I did it, the more everybody loved it, and so on and so on. And I almost got painted into a corner.
I guess that's the trouble with audiences, that if you really cater to what audiences want, you sometimes go too much in one direction. I think that's a problem that some performers have had.
Well, there's a risk of going stale.
Uh-huh.
It's a double bind in a way. I mean, if you go into a performing situation and you do all the old stuff, people who were there, somebody say, well, what'd you do last night? I want to hear Van Ronk. And, what did he do? Same old stuff, But try going in with a whole bunch of new material. And what did you, Van Ronk? Oh, yeah, what did he do? I don't know. Some weird crap I never heard before in my life.
Well, Dave Van Ronk is my guest, and he's got his guitar with him. So let me ask you to do another song for us. Do you want to do a song you recently added to your repertoire?
All right. See if this thing works. I don't know. I haven't done this too much. This is a thing I picked up from Josh White. I learned it. My God. I couldn't have been more than 14 or so when I learned the song, but I just started to do it a few months ago.
Gee, which one of us is supposed to patter as you tune? Is it my job as the host or yours as the guitarist? This is a song I learned. Oh, excuse me.
This is called Sometime, and it's...
Thank you.
What you gonna do when your shoes give out, my baby? What you gonna do when your shoes give out, my honey? When my shoes give out, I'm gonna quit the street. I'm gonna take a chair, put a fan on my feet for some time. What you gonna do when the bread gives out, my baby? What you gonna do when the bread gives out, my honey? What you gonna do when the bread gives out? I'm gonna lay across the bed with my mouth in a pout for some time. What you gonna do when the meat gives out, my baby? What you gonna do when the meat gives out, my honey? When I got no meat, no bread, no shoes, lay across the bed with my head in the blues for some time. Blam to blam in the morning. Slats in the bed go blam to blam in the evening. Slats in the bed go blam to blam, but I'll keep on trucking like I don't give a damn for some time. What you gonna do when your man gives out, my baby? What you gonna do when the man gives out, my honey? First I grab my money, kick him off the place, and I'll use the other man I had around just in case for some time.
What took you so long to add that song to your repertoire?
Well, it was a question of finding a handle for it.
What kind of
I wanted to do something with it that was totally unlike what Josh had done. I didn't want to do a Josh White imitation, and it was just finding the right way to go about it, and it was one of those things that kicked around the back, kick around the back of your head for years and years and years, and then sooner or later you're going to find something that's going to go with it. That is to say, on the guitar. And so I found that this little thing. I just started to fool around with that, and that tune came into my head, and I thought that they were well paired.
Now, the kind of finger picking that you do,
mm-hmm.
Did you learn to do that by watching other musicians do it, or did you just pick it up from listening to records?
Oh, no, I couldn't have picked that up off of records. I mean, the first time I ever heard finger picking guitar, I really thought it was two people. I had no idea. Two people with flat picks, one of them going, and the other one going, you know, that sort of thing. It wasn't until I had read that it was one person, but I had my doubts. It wasn't until I saw people actually doing it when I was about 14 or 15.
So who'd you see and where'd you see them?
Well, the first person, I don't know who the first person actually was, but the first person that I ever buttonholed and got to show me a couple of things was Tom Paley. Tom used to be with the New Lost City Ramblers and so on. He's not living in the States anymore. He's in England now. But I saw Tom over in Washington Square Park circa 1954 or 55 or something like that. And I could see what he was doing dovetailed with a lot of things that I'd been hearing on record. So when he finished up whatever it was he was doing, I just started asking him questions. I was playing some guitar at the time, but I was using a flat pick. And he was very very nice. He showed me what the thumb is supposed to do. And he only uses two fingers. He says that he uses three when he's working something out, but as soon as he gets it down, he goes down to two. But this man has fantastic motor reflexes.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and then I'm going to ask you to play some more, and we'll talk some more about your music. Dave Van Ronk is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Guitarist and singer Dave Van Ronk is my guest. Now, how did you first start playing blues and jazz in the first place? So did you have listened to it on a lot of records before you started playing it yourself?
Yeah. When I was about 14 or 15, I started to collect jazz records. I was very eclectic at first, being partial to, Charlie Christian, Dexter Gordon, Dizzy Gillespie, and also the traditional stuff, the older stuff, Jelly Roll Morton and King Oliver, Bessie Smith. And some friends of mine and I in the old neighborhood in Queens decided we were going to put together a traditional jazz band. I picked up a tenor banjo. I had been playing some guitar already. So tenor banjo, at least as far as the chords were concerned, was no big problem. Although if I picked one up now, I doubt if I could make a C chord. And so we were trying to play old-time traditional jazz. And I was, since I had been singing before that, I was, you know, I was it band vocalist. most jazz musicians don't like to sing. They really don't. And if you're willing to take the vocals, if the band needs a vocalist and you're willing to take the vocals, they'll put up with a lot of stuff, including bad chords. I found that out. I was always missing the changes. But nobody else wanted to do the vocals, so that gave me my entree. And so for about 5 or 6 years, I was doing that, playing tenor banjo and doing vocals with various traditional bands, mostly pickup groups. And which has stood me in good stead ever since, because I know the book now.
Well, since you're talking about how you started off singing jazz, maybe you'd do a jazz song for us.
Okay, sure. Bible says, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. The rich gets rich, why the weak ones fade. Your empty pockets don't ever make the grade. Mama may have, Papa may have, God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Money you got, lots of friends crowding round your door. Funny when you're gone and spending ends, they don't come no more. Rich relations may give crusts of bread and such. Help yourself, but don't take too much. Your mama may have, Papa may have, God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Do
da-da-da. Man, you've got lots of friends crowding round your door. Funny when you're gone and spending ends, they don't come no more. Rich relations may give crust to bread and such. Help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have papa, may have God. Bless the child that's blessed, that's got his own.
Nice. Scat singing something new for you? Scat singing something new for you?
Oh, no, I've been doing it for a long, long time. But again, it's... What I'm doing now is not the way I did it. See, I'm more interested in musical ideas now than in tonal effects.
You're still on the road a lot, touring in different places. How has the club scene changed for you? The clubs for folk singers and soloists. It's odd. I'm never really sure what to call you. Obviously, what you're doing isn't exclusively folk. I mean, we've certainly heard evidence of that.
Well, I don't think there are too many people in the field who are actually folk musicians.
Yeah.
Very few of us are really traditional singers. Yeah. Some of us sing in more or less traditional styles. That's the main difference. Some of the most ethnic people I know, you'll go home and read James Joyce or whatever. These are stylistic choices that people make, essentially. We're all concert and cabaret performers.
Yeah, yeah. Is there much of a club circuit now to perform on?
Well, yeah, it's been... Things have been picking up over the last few years, certainly. I don't think we're going to see another great big folk scare or anything like that in the foreseeable future, but certainly it's a lot better than it was 10 years ago, an awful lot more clubs and there are more concerts, and you can keep a lot more busy.
Do you look back nostalgically on the days of the late 50s, early 60s, when the folk boom was at its peak and there were so many clubs flourishing in Greenwich Village?
No. No.
How come?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of good things about it, but time marches on, and I mean, there are some things that I miss about it. I miss being able to walk to work and keep busy. That was nice. I miss the fact that a great many really first-rate talents were being attracted to traditional music. I mean. People like Jose Feliciano and Bob Dylan never would have been attracted if the zeitgeist hadn't been right, and so you miss that kind of thing. But I mean, I don't really miss the tacky street scene. I mean, we still have the tacky street scene in the village. I still live there. I have to walk out into the middle of it every day when I'm home, and it's kind of a drag. But I don't miss being in the midst of all that.
I just want to ask you something quickly. Do you feel that you've, in a way, grown into some of the songs that you sing, some of the songs about being on the road or living hard or things like that?
No, not really. I mean, in a sense, I suppose I have, but... When you're singing a song about your hard traveling and so on, if you haven't done any hard traveling at all, it doesn't make any difference. Everybody has experiences that they sublimate in one way or another into the music that they're doing. And it, a person with no experience is a person who hasn't been born yet.
I just looked at the time. We have a little over a minute left. I really wanted you to play one of your songs, and we'll only have time for like a couple of choruses.
Oh, well. We'll do a couple of choruses. Not a nickel, not a pen in my name. I'm the king of Tap City and I'm out of the game. A nickel up, a nickel down, another nickel gone. Ain't got a nickel left to carry me on if I ever get back on my feet. Move from Saturday Alley up to Sunday Street, yeah. A paradise that makes me seven all the time. I'm gonna be living on chicken and wine. I want caviar, four-star Johnny Walker Black, and six pretty women in my gold Cadillac. I'm gonna move where the living is sweet. From Saturday Alley up to Sunday Street, yes.
Dave, you really sound great. I want to thank you so much for coming and playing with us today. Thank you so much for being here. My guest has been Dave Van Ronk, and we thank him very much for coming and performing for us. On our next Fresh Air, I'll speak with journalist Paul Eddy. He began an investigation of the cocaine cartel in Colombia when he was a reporter for the London Sunday Times. His investigation of cocaine trafficking from Colombia to Miami is the basis of his new book, Cocaine Wars. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. With the presidential elections just a few months away, it's the busy season for political satirist and stand-up comic Will Durst. Coming up, a glimpse at how he puts together his material. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews In Seattle, the new album from bassist Michael Bizio's quartet. It's a prime example of what Kevin calls the new mainstream. And TV critic David Bianculli discusses how we Americans cover the most British of sporting events, Wimbledon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The Securities and Exchange Commission has charged two men with engaging in illegal insider trading on Wall Street. The two are alleged to have made $19 million over the past year. NPR's Mike Schuster has details.
It's the second largest insider trading scheme in U.S. history, according to the SEC, surpassed only by the activities of Ivan Boesky, who is now in prison. The SEC has brought civil charges against Stephen Wang and Fred Lee. Wang is a 24-year-old financial analyst at the Wall Street firm of Morgan Stanley. Lee is a 38-year-old businessman from Taiwan with real estate and import-export interests from Hong Kong to McLean, Virginia. According to the SEC, Wang gave non-public insider information on various mergers, tender offers, and leveraged buyouts to Lee, who then traded securities in at least 33 brokerage accounts. There were 25 stocks involved over the past year, including E.F. Hutton and the Stop & Shop grocery chain. The SEC says Lee paid Wang $200,000 for the information. The SEC's is a civil action. No word today on whether the two might face criminal charges. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
The Reagan administration today announced a new policy that would require the president to give his consent before the Justice Department issues indictments naming foreign leaders. The White House hopes the move will prevent a recurrence of the embarrassment it suffered after the indictment of Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega on drug charges. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The new policy reportedly rests on an informal agreement between Secretary of State Shultz and Attorney General Meese that they will get the president's approval before proceeding with any attempt to indict a foreign leader on criminal charges. It's been described as an effort to ensure the foreign policy goals of such an indictment are weighed before proceeding. Administration officials are known to regret the failed attempts to oust Noriega from office based on his indictment by a federal grand jury in the U.S. and are anxious to prevent a recurrence. Administration officials say President Reagan was aware of the indictments brought against Noriega before they were made public, but was never formally asked to approve them. Under the new policy, the president must give the green light to such an indictment before it can go forward. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
The Supreme Court today ruled in favor of local communities in a case involving anti-abortionists. The court ruled 6-3 that communities can ban picketing at individual homes. Despite free speech activists who say such a ruling impinges on their rights, the justices decreed there is no right of forcing speech on an unwilling listener. The Supreme Court case is a defeat for anti-abortionists who were banned by a Wisconsin community from picketing a doctor's home. Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci today cautioned against rushing to reform the military procurement system as the Pentagon fraud and bribery scandal unfolds. But he told the National Press Club he has a task force ready to look at changes. Details from NPR's Ann Garrels.
In an apparent plea to Congress where lawmakers are preparing a range of reforms, Carlucci said the last thing we need now are hasty piecemeal changes that could make matters worse. And he urged those who would change the system now to wait. According to law enforcement officials, as many as 100 military contracts may have been tainted by bribery and collusion. Carlucci says he does not have information on this yet and once again urged caution.
We have to worry about the national security. If you begin to slow down contracts or stop them in the absence of any evidence, then the costs escalate enormously.
But Carlucci said he would not have to wait for convictions before taking action. Though Carlucci cautioned against hasty reforms, he did urge Congress to streamline the way it allocates money for weapon systems. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Stock prices fell sharply on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 34 points to close at 2108.46. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album by bassist Michael Bisio and his quartet. Kevin says they're typical of a new jazz mainstream, following traditional structures, but treating them in sometimes raunchy ways. On this tune, Blues for Melodious Tea, Bisio adapts pianist Thelonious Monk's dissonant blues style to his pianoless quartet.
Thank you. 1950s, jazz critic Stanley Dance coined the term mainstream to describe music that straddled the fence between revolutionary bebop and conservative swing. The term stuck for good reason. We need a word for that stuff. But more important than the word mainstream was the concept it pinned down. At any time in jazz, when opposing factions wage ideological warfare, there are always musicians who bypass controversy to combine the new and the old. In the 1960s, when musical disputes were particularly violent, labels like Blue Note put out dozens of records blending soulful hard bop with urgent free jazz. Bassist Michael Bizio's quartet, whose new album In Seattle is on the Silkart label, is a trumpet, alto, bass, and drums unit modeled on two contrasting, you might say opposing, 1950s groups. Jerry Mulligan's early 50s quartet got rid of the piano player but followed the chord changes as if they still had one. Ornette Coleman's late 50s quartet threw out the chord structures with the piano, opting for a rougher, backwoodsy sound. Bizio's quartet borrows from both. They play the changes and echo Coleman's bluesy cry. Check out their 2-minute version of Rosson Roland Kirk's A Laugh for Rory. That's bassist Michael Bizio with trumpeter Ron Soderstrom, alto saxophonist Rick Van Dyke, and drummer T.O. Sutton. I really like their mix of tunefulness and exuberance. With everything anchored to Bizio's neat bass lines, the structures are clearly defined, but that doesn't prevent the horn players from jumping in and out of each other's way. Bizio Quartet fits into a new mainstream that includes saxophonist David Murray and Chico Freeman, orderly players some folks mistake for fire-breathing radicals. Part of that misperception has to do with the labels that stick to the music, not all of which are as useful as the term mainstream. The liberating innovations Ornette Coleman introduced are still referred to as avant-garde, the new music, or the new thing, even though they hit the scene 30 years ago. Labels like the new music, or for that matter, the one I just used, the new mainstream, are doomed because nothing stays new forever. Some modern jazz is known as free bop, a cross between free jazz and bebop, right? That's a term I like because it defines itself and emphasizes continuity within the tradition. Michael Bizio's music is more conservative than free bop, but calling it new mainstream only lets us postpone thinking up a more descriptive label. Still, as monikers go, it may have to do until a real name comes along.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed In Seattle, the new album by bassist Michael Bizio and his quartet. It's on the Silkheart label. This is Fresh Air. Will Durst is a news junkie. His habit feeds his comedy. In the New York Times, Stephen Holden wrote, "Durst is regarded by most observers as one of the sharpest political comics in the country. His onstage delivery has the punchy, passionate, macho swagger of an extremely well-read barroom politician."
So, President Reagan's having some problems, huh? Teflon president finally met his metal spatula. Trading arms to Iranian moderates for hostages. What's an Iranian moderate? Is that a father who restricts his kids' use of live grenades?
Come on, kids, it's almost midnight. Put the pins back in, let's go to bed.
Oh, Dad, you're such a moderate.
Will Durst has performed on television and in comedy clubs. I asked him if he thinks these are fertile times for political comedy.
The abyss is just over the edge for us, because once Reagan leaves, you know, I think it's going to be Dukakis. I think America is going to go with a change, because they usually do. I know my parents are, you know, my parents are crazy blue-collar people from the Midwest, and they're wonderful people, but my parents always believe in, they've had their 8 years, you know, let's give somebody else a chance, and they really believe that. And so that's why I definitely think it's going to be Dukakis, and I think Dukakis is going to be scary for me, because he's a one-note joke. You know,
and it's, what's the joke if he's a one-note joke?
He's boring. Uh-huh. and of course, we get to know so much about all of these guys. I think there will always be something to pick on him. But I guess I'm kind of liberal. So I think it's easier for me to take out a conservative than it will be for me to take out a liberal. I'm really frightened of Dukakis. I really am. I'm going to go back to aluminum siding. I don't know why.
Well, elections are always a fertile period for political humor. How carefully are you following the campaigns? What do you read every day?
I read about 5 newspapers, and then I try to fortify that with a mess of magazines. I haven't read a book in about 3 months. There's so much you have to read, you know, just to get a tiny little bearing. And you never know. I never know when something is going to key me into a joke. Like, I'm trying a new joke. George Bush, last week, I don't know if you saw this in the news, George Bush was courting the black vote. And that just seems so silly to me. He's courting the black vote with what? Apologies? Money? What? Gifts? Candy? Food?
For those of us who've seen you on TV, but not in clubs, are there things that you can do in performance that you feel you have to hold back from doing on television?
Oh, yeah.
What kinds of things?
There's a lot of things that you can't do in the tube because they're afraid that you might go too far or they have sponsors. And also, a lot of times on TV, they're just afraid. They don't want you to do political stuff because it doesn't wear date well. They also don't like me to pick on religion. And there's a couple lines that I got in trouble with on TV.
Can I ask you about a television appearance that you made? This is a night you were on the Late Show.
Ah.
Right? And so you were on the couch at this point, and you were talking with the host.
Somebody told me you did a music video. Now, I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, I did one of the MTV things for Greg Kinn.
Really? Now, what's your part? What do you do?
I was a scumball. I was in
Which
an
is a stretch
alley.
For you, though, wasn't it?
Lovely hair. Where'd you buy it?
That was a pretty kind of insulting, insulting thing you said to the host, because it made you think, "Yep, that definitely is a hairpiece." And all the audience really laughed, and it seemed like that they were taking this opportunity to kind of laugh at the host. And I thought, "Boy, that host looks really uncomfortable."
No, see, but what he did to me was he set me up so, you know, I'm gonna play the role of a sleaze or something, and he said, "Oh, not much of a stretch for you." So he insulted me, so I had to come back at him. I think everybody sets out their standards, and then, these are the rules, and then you play by them, and then I beat you by those rules. I think that's fair and right and true and just, don't you, Terry?
Hey, I don't know, should I identify with the host in this situation?
No, you should. Oh, downtrodden young comedian, I think.
Oh, well, did you get any flack from that? You know, I was wondering if this is an unspoken agreement that, you know, you don't insult the host of the show that you're on.
No. He's a wonderful man. He really is. He's really a gracious man. And he's one of these guys who thinks whatever is good for the show makes him look good. So you can put him down, and as long as it's good for the show, he'll think he had a wonderful time.
So give me more of a sense of the kind of material that you'd feel perfectly comfortable doing in a club, but you think would be considered too timely, too topical, or too extreme to do on television.
When you see me in a club, you'll be seeing me work out almost test jokes, you know, keep trying to test the waters. Oh, this is working. Okay, now change that a little bit and fine-tune that to the right. And when I get to TV, I mean, that stuff has to be, you know, totally pixelated. I mean, it's got to be, you know, totally edited, and I have to know where I'm going, and there's not much room for improv.
So what are you going to test out in your current performance?
Well, I'll be talking about the Pentagon waste and, you know, what new news this is, the $800 toilet seat and the $7,622 coffee pot. And this coffee pot is able to brew Java while the jet undergoes G-forces that kill the entire crew. That's true. Just think of that. Now the FAA investigates a crash. All they got to bring is a sweet and low. You like that, Tara?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. It needs more work. Trust me, it does.
Well, how are you going to work on it? What are you going to do if it needs more work?
Well, for me, when I go on stage, it's all a sham. It's smoke and mirrors, and I use a lot of tricks to make the audience think that, you know, I'm just thinking of stuff on the spot. And sometimes I know a joke is funny. I know it's funny, and it's not working. And I got a joke like that right now. And it's not working. You want to hear the joke?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Reagan's trying to force Noriega. He's trying to smoke Noriega out of Panama by forcing him to run it under a deficit. You know what that means? 4 more years. See, now, I think that's a hysterical joke, and the audience just... They just give me total trout. So I think the setup's too long. Either that, or I gotta set up another deficit joke in front of it, or maybe do something with the 4 more years, you know. And this is just nuts and bolts and the machinery and gears and stuff that you guys don't need to know about, you know. But
so if you set up another deficit joke before it, that would be to make the connection between Reagan's deficit and Noriega's?
Right. And to make them already used to the word deficit. So it's kind of like a callback. A lot of times I just write down setup, something that I think is a setup, and then I wait for the punchline, hopefully, to come. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. I get about 15 or 20 in my notebook. I got, you know, and the setup is perfectly phrased. And it's a genius setup. And I just don't have a joke there yet.
Can you share one of the setups that's waiting for a punchline?
Yes. They say that Dukakis has a passion gap and George Bush has a gender gap. And have you heard that?
No.
Yeah. Well, there's no joke there. But because they both got gaps, and I figured there's, you know, and Reagan's got a brain gap or, you know, a skull pan gap, or, you know, and I'm trying to work on something there, and it's nothing's coming. And I don't think it will. That one looks...
No, I think you're going to find something there between the passion and the gender.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something going on there. You ran for mayor in San Francisco in 1987?
Yes.
What was that about?
That was a mistake. It was a major mistake on my part. I went up there to make a pimp of the process. I wanted to make fun of what it was to be as a politician, walk a mile in their shoes,
and some of the voters, and you would go to these candidate forums, and they would look at you with their bright eyes and their fresh faces, and I'd be doing jokes, and they'd just go, oh, come on, man, we don't need this.
It sounds like you were campaigning as if it were a lot of stand-up dates.
I did in the beginning, but then at the end I couldn't.
Uh-huh.
Because I didn't want to disappoint the people.
When you see George Bush or Michael Dukakis now making a stump speech, do you think to yourself, yeah, I know what it's like to do that?
Kinda. No, that's one of the reasons why I did run for mayor of San Francisco, because let us not cast the first aspersion until we've walked a mile in their shoes. And then I walked a mile in, and they can't be real people. They just cannot be. They have to be models of who they think they should be or who they think the public wants them to be.
Is it easier to get laughs than it is to get votes?
For me, it was. I don't know if George Bush really has a sense of humor. It might be easier for him to get votes than laughs. But
okay, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Comic Will Durst.
Gaddafi, what a liquid cheese brain. No terrorist camps in Libya. Yeah, right. And Formica is edible. Guy spells his name with a Q. It's not followed by a U. He plays by rules we don't even understand. I like that. Of course, Reagan, the first living brain donor.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Cherry.
So what are you doing?
Well, we have a report on more insider trading disclosed on Wall Street. Also, Frank Carlucci, the defense secretary, defends his department against the various charges that have made regarding defense procurement. We have an interview with the authors of a history of the law firm Sullivan & Cromwell. They reveal John Foster Dulles, the great lawyer of that firm and later Secretary of State under President Eisenhower, to have been such an ardent supporter of German causes through his career that he was not deterred by the rise of Nazism there, and actually was active in some cases that probably did help the Nazis.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Wimbledon is the oldest and most famous of all the championship tennis matches. The games have begun, and our television critic David Bianculli has some advice for the TV announcers who cover the event.
Television used to think of tennis as a snooty sport with limited appeal, which explains why it used to be shown mostly on public TV. That was where snooty things with limited appeal were supposed to be shown. Somewhere along the line, though, tennis became big business for TV. NBC has been covering the Wimbledon championships for 20 years now, and HBO has been covering early round Wimbledon matches for 14. The changes in the game have come more recently. The rackets are bigger, the balls are brighter, even Wimbledon is using yellow tennis balls now, the players are louder, and so, unfortunately, are the announcers. Don't get me wrong, there are times when TV's coverage of tennis is just right. Last year, when Pat Cash won Wimbledon and jumped into the stands to hug his dad, it was a great TV moment, because NBC had caught reaction shots of Cash's father all through the match. You knew who he was, where he was, and how excited he was. On the other hand, you also had to endure the endless gibberish of Bud Collins, who is to TV tennis what Ted Baxter was to TV news. As far as the talk goes, things are much better on HBO. But even there, the announcers have gotten way too noisy. Former ABC sports analyst Jim Lampley is part of HBO's team this year, and he and Arthur Ashe like to talk a lot. It's intelligent talk, at least, but it's still a lot of noise. Listen to this second-round showdown point from last Thursday between Jimmy Connors and Australia's Jason Stoltenberg. Connors is serving triple match point while Ashe and Lampley are chatting away.
So, triple match point.
And as you said, Jim, he is just about to put away the point for his 80th Wimbledon victory.
Thank you.
In the men's singles competition, called the gentlemen's singles here, officially.
Now, athletes in some sports, most particularly Pete Rose, know every statistic in their career. You suppose Jimmy knows this would be his 80th win?
I think he does. He's not going to brag about it, but he knows.
Game, set, match, Connors. Make it 80.
What's so bad about that? Well, listen to another match point from the same day's coverage. The players are John McEnroe and Australia's Wally Masur. Masur is serving, and the difference is that HBO, instead of using its own announcing crew, is relying on the center court announcers for the BBC.
Quiet, please. Thank you.
And it's 40-30, and it's match point.
Quiet, please.
McEnroe won that point, but lost the match. The real winners, though, were the British announcers, who know that the most dramatic parts of the game don't require any words. NBC knows that when it comes to baseball, but can't seem to shut up when it comes to tennis. There are times, even in broadcasting, when the best thing to do is to keep quiet. Therefore, my advice to NBC, as it gets ready for this weekend's Wimbledon final, is to listen to this.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Jeanette Winterson was a teenaged evangelical preacher when she fell in love with an older woman. Rather than give up love, she gave up religion. That's the story of her autobiographical novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about her life and she'll read from her new novel, The Passion. And rock historian Ed Ward will profile Ike Turner. Though he's best known for the scandal-filled years when he worked with his wife Tina Turner, Ike's musical career began long before they met. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Ed Doherty. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Dan Cornwell. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.